everybody, and welcome to this episode of the Pat Falvey podcast. And this week we're going to take a look at what it feels like to climb Mount Everest. We're going to look at all the aspects in relation to its dangers, its height, and, you know, the training that's involved in it. Now, in this episode, I'll be looking at two of my attempts in 1993 and 1995. And it's from the north side of Mount Everest. Now, I happen to be very privileged, as I have been to Nepal about 60 times. Mount Everest had been a passion of mine for years. And it all started back here in Kerry, you know, in about 1986, when I did my first climb after I tried to take my life through suicide. I went to climb a small mountain, Mangerton, and to get my mind in calms, as the man says. Someone asked me, would I go hill walking? The following week, I climbed Carn 2, and I was so excited, believe it or not, I stood up and I shouted to my partner at the time, Valdine, I'm going to climb Mount Everest. Well, of course, they all thought I was mad, not known Val, but all the people that were there on the day. And yes, all these years later, I became the first person in the world to have climbed Everest North and South, including the seven summits, twice. So you might be wondering, what did it take? Well, it took passion, belief, training, and basically, you know, the ability to conquer fears. And conquering fears, like, if I may say so, is something that I love now doing. Well, I never forget when I came home and told my family, yes, I'm going to climb Mount Everest. Of course, the first thing they all did was laugh. And then when they seen I was serious, they, you know, started coming up with all the excuses why I shouldn't. And I never forget my dad coming to me. And of course, this sometimes will drive the fear in yourself. And he said, Sonny, says, look, you can't climb Mount Everest. You not realize you'll die. So I was wondering where he was coming from that. And then he came up with the statistic. He says, did you know, he says, that 395 people have climbed Mount Everest in the world? And he said, 112 have died. And I said, so what? He said, son, that's one in four. He said, like, he says, look, he says, you don't have very much experience on this. So, you know, you might die and we'd all be in a fair state. So on that note, what I did do is I thought to myself, and I was kind of thinking what he said, except he had said, like, you know, why don't I take up golf instead? But anyway, the following morning on the Cork Examiner, believe it or not, I picked up the front page and it says, golfer hit by golf ball and dies. Well, that was the end of that. So I went back to my dad and I said, Dad, yeah, you're right in relation to 395 climbers have climbed it and 112 had died. So that meant three had lived. So one of four would have died and three would lived. So what I did is, with the conviction of the passion I had now for doing this, I went away and I researched everybody that had climbed Mount Everest and everybody who had died on Everest. And I came up with the conclusion, yes, that I would have the ability to live. And what I was going to do is to set out and attempt it. But first, what I would have to do is I would have to put myself in a situation where I would be self-reliant in relation to climbing this mountain. In other words, I spent a few years learning all about mountain rescue techniques by joining Kerry Mountain Rescue. I did all the self-assessment training. I became proficient and efficient in movement, in stamina. There was times, believe it or not, with the stream knowing, like, in store, I used to climb Ireland's highest mountain, you know, three times a day, sometimes 4 days a week, just to build up the strength. Now, lucky enough, there was an international team of climbers climbing it, an international team of, say, I think it was 12 different nationalities. There was Russians, Poles, there was guys from Finland, France, and of course, there was this little meager me, an Irish person who had a dream and had a goal, but who now spent 6 years training in all the skills that were required to do so. So I became a self-efficient mountaineer and had no fear of the fact that I wouldn't be as good as anybody else. So lo and behold, In August 1993, I packed my bags. We arrived at the airport. I was joining the expedition leader at the time was John Tinker. All my family came out to see me off and they were all crying. And here I was like getting onto a plane. I was on my own. I was meeting up with an international team in Kathmandu. And I remember going out the door and my dad and my mom hugging me and they said, son, we'll have the candles burning for you. So please come back. So in relation to that, I had to beat off all the negativity that was actually going on in my own mind. So I hugged and I kissed them and I headed off, also realizing that this could indeed be the last time that I'd ever see them, if it's a case that I was to die on Mount Everest. And because it was my first time, yeah, of course, I had all those fears that I wouldn't be coming back. And also that I didn't have the security of what would usually be, you know, a team that I would have known around me, even though I did get to know some of them in Scotland. So on arriving in Kathmandu, met up with all the team and there was some amazing climbers there. And we headed for base camp. On this occasion, we were heading to the north side of Everest. And it was an amazing journey. Like we went up into Sangmu and up into Nilam. And then we went across this amazing road, which is called the Road to Hell, where there was thousands of drop-offs on either side of us. And even on our first attempt out there, before we even got to the mountain, we were in a monsoon period. And I've seen a number of families just washed away in the monsoons by cascading avalanches of mud and dirt coming off as we traversed over this roadway. We got to base camp and the excitement was palpable in the sense of that here we were in the mist, it was snowing, everything was covered. And, you know, our objective, which was Mount Everest, had shrouded herself in a cloud. So we were all very anxious to see, you know, her in her glory. Chomalungma, to those that actually, the natives that know her, is called Mother Goddess of the Earth, or Sagarmatha to the Nepalese. So these places are revered as, you know, a holy place for these people. So at the time, we had an international group, as I said, of 23 climbers. And the following morning, we woke, and I never forget exiting my tent, and there she was in all her glory and her majesty. You know, it was Chomalungma, or Mount Everest. And when I looked up, my heart tucked. In other words, in how in the bloody hell are we going to get to the top of this? But lucky enough, you know, I made my first forays up and down the mountain and arrived at advanced base camp. And over the next 40 days, made very good progress. One of the things I always remember about going here, though, is that the fact of feeling inadequate. And when I arrived back from one of my sorties up and down the mountain, I could see this guy, his name was Carl, he was Mr. Universe, and here he was like pressing up and down on his fingers. And I said to me, oh my God, like what, like, you know, what the bloody hell am I doing here? I felt so inadequate when I seen this guy and his muscles and things, you know, like his fitness level was amazing. But a few days later, believe it or not, Mr. Universe came down the valley and I was going up against him and he was crying. And I said, what's wrong? And he said, I'm going home. And that's when I actually decided that never ever again will I go on appearances of what other people are looking like. And Carl went home and I continued on with our expedition. At this stage, we had also a scientific element to the expedition. There was an astronaut, which was called Carl Hines, and he was there with a team. And what they were doing was measuring the radiations on the rocks of Everest so that they were going to design a suit for that they were going to jump out of the border of space. So we were doing some research on this. So all in all, like, it was very, very exciting. And over the next, you know, 40 days or 39 days, we were up and down the mountain getting ready. And lo and behold, we were ready to go for the summit. And it takes that amount of time for your body to acclimatize. You know, we had put in the fixed ropes. We had all the tents like at Camp 1, Camp 2, Camp 3. And the attempt started to go ahead. And I was picked in the first sections of the team to actually go for the summit. But as I was going for the summit, the astronaut Carl Heinz, you know, got pulmonary edema and cerebral edema and thrombosis at advanced base camp. And lo and behold, as we were about to go for the summit, word came through that Carl was dying. So because he was at advanced base camp, you know, we came down and we tried to evacuate him from Mount Everest. And believe it or not, you know, yes, 1 in 4 would die in the statistics that we had got already. And here we were now watching one of our teammates dying. And we tried to evacuate him. We went down to base camp, or we tried to get down to base camp, but halfway down, Carl died, and we buried him in an icy grave, you know, on the glacier. And this was very, very traumatic. Because at this stage, by the time we got back up to climb and go for the summit again, because we knew there was nothing we could do with Carl, the mountain had changed her mind as if Chumalungma had decided, no, she's closing her veil, you know, to the mountain. You know, before it did, we had two of our climbers get to the summit, Angba Bucheri and Magic Berbica, who was one of my 10 teammates. They had got to the summit as we descended, but it would actually now close us off from making another attempt. Of course, we were all disappointed, but we realized that, you know, and we said Chumalungma, goddess mother of the earth, she must have been angry at the fact that Carl died. So we had no other alternative but to pull back, because if it's the case we were to continue, then more fatalities could have happened. So on leaving Everest, I swore I would be back, and, you know, in honour of Carl, who became a very, very good friend of mine, you know, throughout this period of time. So there it was, my Everest dreams were shattered, and I didn't get to the top, but I knew I had the capability. So 2 years later, after I coming back, I swore I would be back, but 2 years later, the same team had decided to make an attempt again, and I was invited to go. So in 1995, off we headed again to Kathmandu, into the city of the thousand temples, made the same journey up to Nilam, crossed that road to hell, across the Tibetan plateau, arrived at base camp. This stage was a lot more familiar. And here I was now, like, you know, fully prepared and fully confident that I would reach the summit. And of course, at this stage, I think my parents, my mom and dad, like, you know, they were actually doubly as worried because of the fact someone had died on the previous expedition. But I was still intent on going. So at this point in time, we got to base camp and then we started preparing for the summit attempts. Now, it takes 50 days to have your body acclimatized to go to the summit. In other words, your heart and your lungs have to expand in size. You have to endure, you know, very rough conditions. There was temperatures that went down on Everest to about minus 35, minus 40 degrees Celsius. There was winds coming up at 110, 120 kilometers per hour. There was freezing cold. There was avalanches. There was, you know, crevasses in some of the areas that we went into, and there was large ridges to cross. And after about 46 days, 50 days, we decided we would go for a summit attempt. And this is making a long story short. All the details in between are in my book, The Accidental Rebel. You know, the stories of nearly, you know, all my major expeditions from Everest to Antarctica, all the Everest attempts. But this was amazing. We had a fantastic team of people. And again, here I was now about to make an attempt to the summit of my dreams. At this stage, I had done all the training. I had become self-sufficient in every technique that you could imagine. And I was also confident that I would reach the summit if I was given a chance and if Chumalungma didn't close down her flanks and, you know, send me home. So with that in mind, we got to Camp 1, Camp 2, Camp 3. And at this stage, it was the 26th of May. We had left, by the way, on St. Patrick's Day. So like it was a kind of a good omen in one hand that St. Patrick had sent us off and gave us his blessing. So here we were now, right, on the 26th of May, ready to go for the summit. And the summit party on this occasion consisted of, there was myself and James Allen, who, by the way, became the youngest person on the team at the time. He was only 21 and I became his mentor. And, you know, we were in one tent, and then in another tent, you know, opposite us came along Bridget Moore and Mike Smith. Mike was from England and Bridget was from Australia. And if she did this, she'd have been the first, you know, Australian woman to complete the seven summits. So as we were about to go for the summit, you know, we were going to leave at 12 midnight. We weren't taking any Sherpas. This was something we were going to, you know, completely do on our own because we were wanted to be self-sufficient. And what happened that just before 11:30 on the 26th, I get a call on the radio, come in, Pat. You know, come in, James, what are you intending to doing? I look at James, James look at me. If it's a case he reached the summit, he'd be the youngest person in the world ever to have done so. At this stage, I could see James being very nervous. I said, come in, Mike, and come in, Bridget. We're going for the summit. What are you doing? So they said, we are going too. And at the same time, there was another team opposite us, a team that was run by Russell Bryce. He was the expedition leader, and he had one member that wanted to go to the summit, and his name was Michael Vallinana. And therefore, we had agreed that Mike could go with us, and we headed off for the summit. Now, at this stage, we're just above 8,000 metres, and we're heading into this amazing place. Like, the barrier on the north side has three major barriers that you have to cross: the first step, the second step, and the third step. So we got out of the tent. It was freezing cold. We were now crossing a place that Mallory and Irving, those historic adventurers who were presumed to have climbed Mount Everest, you know, many years previous, and we were following in their footsteps. Only later it was found out that they didn't, because they never got back. So now we were going from our high camp and we were crossing this amazing steep traverse to our first barrier on the first step. And by the time we got there, our team had split up, you know, into two groups. There was Michael and Bridget, and then there was Mike, James and I ahead. And by the time we got to the first barrier across the steep, sloping, shingles-type slope, it's like that of a roof, we didn't see Bridget and Michael coming. So we hung on for a while and then had decided that they must have turned back and continued. Now, maybe we should have stuck together, but in reality, we had, you know, just got to this place, so we had to make a decision whether to go back or continue. So knowing that they were in a safe territory, that they would make it back, Mike, James and I continued on across to the second step. And the second step, again, is in the dead zone. And remember now, like, we're operating in the dead zone, in a place like that people fear. It's not called the dead zone for nothing. We come into the second step, and this is where one of the major barriers is of the mountain. We arrived there together, and here there's a ladder that had been put in, you know, in the early days by the Chinese. And it's a very, very steep, it's nearly vertical for about 30 meters. The first is that Mike makes his way in onto the step, climbs up over the step, calls down and says, you know, like, okay, climb when ready. So then I went into the step, climbed, and as I was climbing up, I never forget it, the ladder was very shaky. It's, you know, at 90 degrees, you know, it's like it's straight up. And when you get to the top of the ladder, you have to make a move over onto a small hold with your legs and then release the ladder, and you're in midair for a small period of time. And if you fall, you're going to fall into the abyss below. So I made the move. Then I got up to Mike. We hugged each other. We were now in the final stages towards the summit of Mount Everest. At this point in time, James, you know, comes into the ladder to make the climb. But when he gets to the top of the ladder, he's in fear. I can see he's shaking. He has hammer legs, right? Okay, in the sense of shaking. And he looks up at me and he says, "I can't make the move, Pat." I look at him and say, "Come on, James, you can do it." In that sense, you know, he just froze. And then he says, "You know, I'm going down." And I was completely shocked because this was my teammate. I said, "Come on, James, you can make the move." And he said, "Pat, I can't make the move. You continue and I'll go down." So I said, "For F's sake, James, make the move." And he said, "No, he's going down." He said, "Go ahead." And at that point in time, I left James, Mike and I left James on the second step. And we continued towards the summit of our dreams, which is Mount Everest. And as we walked along, you know, I started getting a guilty conscience and I was about to turn and see how James was, like, you know, had safely got off that second step. But as I turned, believe it or not, up pops James's head. He had made the move. When he got up to me, he said, "Pat, you know, I'm going for the summit." We gave each other a hug and he said, "But I think I've got frostbite on my finger." He took one of his two pairs of gloves off, and to make that move later, he would lose 2 fingers. So it was a lovely day. We were now on top of the world. We were at the highest gangplank on planet Earth, and we moved slowly. At this stage, we were using oxygen, and it was 2 liters per minute, and it was really, really slow. In the sense, like they say at altitude, to carry a standard pack is equivalent to carrying a man on your back at sea level. So here we were, going across, heading for the upper reaches of the mountain. We crossed the third step, which was the next barrier, and the next barrier isn't, you know, 150, 200 meters from the summit of Mount Everest. All the time breathing. At this point in time, I never forget the way I was feeling. I didn't know whether I was alive or dead. It felt as I was in a 2-dimensional state. And as I made my way towards the summit, something strange came over me. It was as if I was walking along the ridge itself, but I was looking out and I thought I could see another Pat Falvey up there in the sky. And it was really felt real. And I was in 2 dimensions and it was saying, "What are you doing up there?" You know, then I realized, am I alive or am I dead? And then as the person up there was looking down on this mortal being actually slogging his way to the summit, you know, he was saying, like, you know, like, "What are you doing down there?" It was like as if my body parted in 2, not knowing whether I was alive and not knowing whether I was dead. For the next hour, I slogged my way slowly in this 2-dimensional form. And then, eventually, I had reached the summit. It was the 27th of May, 1995. And the time was 9:10 a.m. in the morning. Once I hit the summit, I got a slap on the back from Mike and said, "Well done, Pat." James gave me a hug. And at that point in time, I wasn't in 2 dimensions anymore. I was actually joined with my outer body experience on my body. And I said, "Oh, my fuck. I'm on top of the world." At that point in time, it was so exciting to feel, you know, the adrenaline that was pumping in my body. I looked around me and I pivoted and I could see 360 degrees right around the world. And what I told to myself at that point in time, I was, with James and Mike, the highest people on planet Earth. A dream was made a reality. I thought about what my father had said. He said, "Son, when I was only 17, dream and dream big, but always remember this, in the following of the dream is where the success lies. Achieving your goal is the bonus." Well, yes, I had a great time going after my goal. I visited many, many countries and many, many places. I had met amazing friends. I had trained myself in from an apprentice to become a master in relation to my art of that as a climber. I believed in myself and I took the chances to beat the odds, of which at the time would have been said to be a game of Russian roulette. But as I stood there, I looked around the world and I thought to myself, you know, if I could do this, anyone could do it. And I realized everybody has an Everest. There's not one person in the world that don't have an Everest. As I stood there, you know, when you stand there, like, you know, you feel pride of country, pride of family, pride of all of those that helped you, all those unsung heroes that would help. And as I did that, I put my hand into my pocket. And by the way, the size of Everest is only the size of a kitchen table, 5.5 miles high in the sky, just to give you an instance of it. It's at a height at which jetliners cruise. And my God, I was so proud. I was shaking with joy. I put my hand into my pocket and I took from it the emblem of my country and the symbol of my tradition and culture. And this I put on an ice axe. And I am a proud Irishman. And I actually swung it high in the air and I said, yes, I have done it. And that was it. A dream was made a reality. As James and Mike, you know, stood there doing exactly the same thing, I knew it was time to go. At this stage, James came to me and said, I'm bursting to go to the toilet. And I said, what? On top of the world. So Mike was saying, look, I'd taken another couple of pictures. So I turned and headed back down the ridge towards the second step. Well, anyway, you could say that James had the highest number two in the world. You know, I'm sure it blew off since then. As I was descending down the mountain and my two partners followed behind me, Mike got very sick. He started to get pulmonary edema, cerebral edema, thrombosis, and he was dying. So I got to the second step and he was coming behind me. But just before, as I skipped it, before I turned off the summit, I had a chat with Chimalungma herself. And that was to say, I'll be back. I had such a great experience. And what I did know at the time, nobody in the world had climbed Everest north or south. And I said, I'll be back. But I wanted an objective. I said, no Irish female had ever summited Everest up to that point. And I said, look, I'll be back and I'll have an Irish team to go from Nepal. Again, no Irish team had ever summited from Nepal and no Irish female had ever summited Mount Everest. And I said, I will be back with a team and I will see you again sometime in the future when I was descending. But it's, you know, that was the promise I made. And, you know, I was also so proud of the fact that Mum and Dad would be so proud of my own family as I descended. But anyway, saying that, I got back to the second step. Mike was dying and it took us 2 days to get him off the mountain, but he survived. You know, this, for more details of all of that, which is in full details, is in my book, The Accidental Rebel, that if it's a case that you ever get a chance to read it. Also, I was to return to base camp, and believe it or not, at the time we didn't have mobile phones or anything like that. And when I was going to the summit, we had got a phone call out from a satellite phone to say I was going to the summit. But when I got back down, didn't the generator break? There was no communication and we couldn't get a message back to the rest of the world that I had reached the summit and I was back safely. Then the press picked up on that and it was 5 days before they would find out whether I did get to the summit or not, but it went out because I had said earlier that if it's a case we break communication, that there's trouble on the mountain. I didn't realise like that our generator would break and not be able to let us get out a message. So therefore, the press went wild. They had printed that, you know, fear of Pafalvi dying on Everest. It was picked up by the national news. There was press and cameras outside my wife's house at the time. And she not knowing, or my family not knowing, whether I was alive or dead. Anyway, they're making a long story short, it took us 5 days before I got the news back. And when I got back to Ireland, I was absolutely nearly massacred because of the fact, you know, my family would never talk to the press again about anything I did because they were in such fear at the time that I might have died on Everest. So anyway, we got back to base camp and Mike actually recovered, but it took him another 5 days to recover. And the news had got home that I had summited. Now came the fact, because I had already been on the satellite phone to my family and they were giving out mad and stink about the press. So I was half concerned about coming home and the reaction I would get. But anyway, here I was, got back to Kathmandu, the city of the thousand temples. We celebrated and we thanked, you know, Buddha, we thanked the Sacred Heart, we thanked everybody. And I never forget the journey home. It was amazing. There I was, just on my own, heading back into Ireland, not expecting anything, because at this stage I didn't realise the press that this whole expedition had got. And when I arrived and I was flying in on an Aer Lingus flight into Cork Airport, which is where I would usually come back to because that is my home, I knew my family would be there. At this stage, by the way, my father was also elected Lord Mayor of Cork City, so he was his first citizen. And as I flew back in, the hostess came down to me and she said, "Are you Pat Falvey?" And I was just sitting talking. I said, "I am." And then it came across on the intercom that they had Pat Falvey sitting on the airplane, who actually had climbed Mount Everest from the north side. And then there was a big clap and everyone stood up and I was embarrassed. And then I was told there was a bottle of champagne brought in, and like, I was delighted. I shared it with the people alongside of me. And then they said, "Look, we're about to land in Cork Airport. And what we want you to do is we want you to go to the back of the aircraft, right? And that what we're going to do is leave you all first before anyone else departs." So they told everybody. And I said, "What the God, like, bloody hell is this about?" So anyway, there I was. I was at the back. I was landing in Cork Airport, looking forward to seeing my family, in particular my two kids, Brian and Patrick. And then the door opens and next there was a big hooray of a band outside at the bottom of the runway. And I goes, "Oh my God." The next thing I seen is my mum and dad. And as I descended from the aircraft, my dad had his official gowns, like in his red saffron, like coat of being the Lord Mayor, the big Lord Mayor medal. And he came over to me, like, and there was ministers and everything else there. This was amazing. And he put out his hand and he shook my hand and he said, "By the way, as the first citizen of our county, I just want to welcome back, you know, one of its greatest sons." And he was saying that to me. And he was doing it very in an official manner. And the next thing, he put his hands around me after he did all of this and we got all the photographs, and he put his hands around me and he said, "By the way, son, I fucking love you." And I said, "Oh my God," like, you know. Then my kids came over. Then there was hugs and kisses and bands playing. There was two bands there. And then we marched into the Cork Airport, and inside in the terminal, 1,000 people. And really, it was that energy. I never, ever forget it, like, you know, in relation to the fact that I got off Everest thinking I was flying home just for a low profile coming home. And it gave me such a buzz. And it shows you that, whereas I got all the glory in relation to climbing Everest on this one. But in reality, it's about the unsung heroes. I'd never have climbed Everest without all of those people that had my back. You know, my family, my wife, my sons, that had allowed me to do this. And yeah, like, you could say, like, yeah, I was very selfish. I think that the big problem is when I now came back, I said, I'm off on another series of expeditions to do to finish the seven summits. And of course, that went down like a lead balloon, because, you know, as they were having a party for me that evening and I announced it over the intercom, everybody just go, "Oh no, he's off again." So that was, the trials and tribulations of climbing Mount Everest. And, you know, it's amazing to think that for a small part of time, the history of planet Earth, that I had the chance to stand there once, but now I was going back again on another occasion to have another team from the south side. Heading out of Nepal, I had already now set a new task, and that was that I would complete the seven summits, which is climbing the highest point on the seven continents of this planet. And over the following year and a half, I actually did exactly that. And that set me off on a trend that would later lead me to lead and do 150 expeditions, climb, live with 32 tribes of people, indeed lead our first Irish team back onto the south side of Everest, and also succeed. Over two attempts, and one I nearly died on myself, and again, that's fully explained in The Accidental Rebel. We also had the first Irish female, Claire O'Leary, on the summit, which was an amazing story in itself. And we also had the first Irish team, you know, to summit in 2003 with Jerry MacDonald and Mick Murphy. So more about that, but that's, you know, a little fillet in relation to my attempt on Mount Everest. Of course, it does convert into a long story when you read the book. But if you have any inkling to find out what it's like, what it feels like in the death zone, what it's like to actually be to the nearest place that you could get to heaven. And on top of that, Everest, believe this or not, this is the highest mountain in the world that was one time at the bottom of the sea. Yes, fossils of sea creatures are encrusted up there. So when I was crossing the highest gangplank on planet Earth, the feeling was amazing to think for a small part of time in the history of our planet, an Irishman, a Corkman, a Norrie, a bricklayer, who was a bricklayer at one stage, was standing there. And I say that with pride. That was the beginning of another series that, you know, went on, you know, for many, many years. And I sit here now talking about this with pride. You know, I had a lot of problems as well in relation to people believing in the fact that I could do this. And that's all related in the book, The Accidental Rebel. So if you have any questions, if you want to find out more about Everest, then do just contact us, and I'll only be too delighted to fill in. Or join me down here at the Mountain Lodge in Kerry, you know, sign in for one of your treks or walks. So that's it for today. This is just one part of a story of 150 expeditions. So what I want to do is I want to thank you for listening to another episode. As always, I hope there's at least one piece of advice that you can take from this to help you to succeed in your life ahead. If you'd like to get in touch, I'd love to hear from you. You can find me on Twitter at Pat Falvey, on Instagram at Pat Falvey Explorer, and on our website at www.patfalvey.com. Until next week, slán go fóill.